Produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, VR Hoisington, and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast, episode 389. What Did They Do Next? Part 3B, Bill Bruford, Lark's Tongues in Aspic.
This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 389 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later on. You can always get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week we finally get back to the second part of our look at what Bill Bruford did after leaving Yes. So Mark and I talk individually and then together about King Crimson's Lark's Tongues in Aspic. On the YMP Facebook page this week, Fernando Perdomo, the amazing guitarist who collaborates regularly with Dave Kirzner, amongst others, posted his new tribute to Peter Banks, which is a piece called The Crab. It's remarkable. There's also a great interview with Billy Sherwood on Sonic Perspective's website, where he plays down the possibilities of a Union 2 and sounds slightly less certain about the next studio album, which is interesting. Several listeners have been to the Royal Affair tour this week, amongst them Preston Frazier, who wore a YMP t-shirt and posted lots of photographs of the show and the memorabilia he picked up. That's all very much worth looking at, particularly his signed Roger Dean poster, which says, "For Preston and the YMP." Roger Dean. How wonderful. Here's Preston's comments. "I'm back from the Nashville show last night. Very good. The only difference is there was no Rhythm of Love. I loved the Grand Ole Opry. I was 10 rows back and centre. Steve did remark that he wanted to meet the designer of the hall after the concert because there was too much sound bouncing back to the stage. The performances by the band was excellent overall, except Steve was way ahead of the beat on I've Seen All Good People, the end solo. America had no fire to it, Alan's drumming. If you can see the tour, go." A few other random thoughts. Carl Palmer, ELP Legacy, was fantastic. Asia was excellent with Ron, Tal and Billy. John Lodge was forgettable. I said hello to Roger Dean. The poor guy was at his booth outside in 95-degree heat. He looked worn out. Billy Sherwood posted a shot from the stage at Aurora, Illinois, and apparently you can see Jeffrey Cresselius if you look really closely. In the visitor posts, Doug Curran also shows off his poster, which he got signed by the whole band. He's also pictured with Roger Dean, Arthur Brown. Wow, that guy's amazing. Bumblefoot, Paul B, Carl Palmer, Yes, Asia, basically everyone. Doug is a well-connected guy. Andrew Ledwith wonders if other artists have prog music on in the background as they create like he does. And Jeff Bailey reviews the new album from Billy Sherwood, Citizen in the Next Life. He thinks it's really good, and a great sign for the next Yes album. Ah, Mike O'Connor. He's a real gent. Every time he finds Tormato cropping up on streaming radio, he lets me know. This time it was Arriving UFO. Get your tinfoil hats ready. Joseph Cottrell received Patrick Mraz's self-titled album from Cherry Red Records, and Zach Evans pointed out Rick Beato's top 20 greatest acoustic intros of all time. Guess what Yes song is included? Jamie McQuinn sent a photo of him and the legendary Roger Dean, as well as his view of the Royal Affair tour. He says, "I attended the Royal Affair performance in Columbus, Ohio, Friday night. I thought the band sounded terrific. They've shaken off most of the rust that was evident in a few of the early performances that were posted on YouTube. I was thrilled to experience Gates of Delirium live for the first time for me since 1976. Most spectacularly, the adjacent baseball stadium offered up a fireworks display just as the battle sequence was getting underway. Could not have timed it any better. As for Grumpy Steve, I was in the back, so I did not clearly hear what was said, but he did have some harsh words for someone behaving badly in the front rows, on more than one occasion. There are good points on either side of the question whether he should admonish them or not, but I worry if the amount of discussion this is getting will only encourage the next jerk in the front to intentionally see if he can get a rise out of Steve. There are too many people that think that just because they paid for a seat they can heckle the talent, musicians, comedians, etc., regardless of how they might be detracting from the experience for the people around them. Highlight, I met Roger Dean, and my wife surprised me by purchasing one of his prints. I was pretty speechless. The only thing I could tell him was that I had his posters on my bedroom as a teenager." Great stuff. Patrick Gannon points out that Rhythm of Love has been left out of the concerts and replaced with Starship Trooper. Hold on, that's exactly what Mark and I suggested. Steve's listening carefully, clearly. Hi, Steve. Over on Twitter, there was the usual deluge of interesting tweets, including Mark with news of his new album, lots and lots about the Royal Affair tour, and Alan Begg, amongst several others, pointing out the auto-corrected error in last week's episode notes. Listerine, eh? And speaking of last week, the episode prompted a lot of discussion, so do go to the show notes on yesmusicpodcast.com to read the 17 comments there. And I also received no fewer than 4 voicemail messages, not all about last week, so let's have a montage of those.
I've been really enjoying your show the past few weeks, talking about the tour, and I saw the show in the Detroit area last week, and I'd like to give a different perspective of Steve Howe's many moods. I was about 8 seats in front of him, and he did twice ask for some audience members to be quiet. And the second time he used a slang phrase like pipe down or clam up. I forget which one it was. But both times he was talking to 2 people who were right in front of him in the front row, who were trying to have this yelling conversation. They both had their earplugs on. And while he was trying to introduce a song, and it didn't seem out of place at all. You know, he wasn't yelling to all the people up everywhere, you know, having their beer. You know, he was just talking to these 2 guys in front of him who were, I think, being really rude. And, you know, you got to think about the audience goer, the concert goers sitting next to them who also paid a lot of money. They don't want to hear these 2 guys talk. And, you know, of course, Steve Howe deserves the respect. You know, if you were a teacher and some kids in the first row are yammering away, you're not going to, you know, let that slide. I mean, I think it was distracting to him, too. They were louder than he was. I could hear them where I was sitting. Anyway, but he wasn't angry about that. I mean, afterwards, he was in a good mood. It didn't make him grumpy. I think he comes to expect this sort of thing. A couple other things. He walked up to the microphone between songs once, and he says, "Boo." I think this was because all the audience seemed to be afraid to sing or do anything. Though Bumblefoot and John Davidson did do a great job of getting the audience involved from time to time with singing, and the audience happily did sing when prompted. I don't know. It seems like the audience is becoming more of a Japanese audience where they're quiet during the song. But, you know, as it was last week, after every single song, nearly, there's a standing O.
Hi, this is Bill. I just wanted to let you know that I really enjoyed your review of the Royal Affair tour.
Hi, Kevin and Mark. Fred Barringer here from the States, longtime listener, contributor. I've been enjoying all the podcasts, of course. Every week there's something new to dial into. And I appreciate all of it, all the work. I know it takes time. One thing I want to throw your way was about your 2 pences. Wonder if you've ever taken solicitation from your fans. Anyway, I've always wondered what happened to Benoit David since he left Yes after the Fly From Here tour album. And he did 1 more album and tour with Mystery, I believe. But if you could talk about maybe his tenure with Mystery, Yes, and then Mystery again, maybe where is he now? Because I can't seem to find out much about him, but he's a great vocalist. And I think, you know, if he's doing anything, we should know about it. All right, so that's my 2 cents. Let's see if it can become a 2 pence. Bye now.
Hi, Kevin and Mark. It's Simon Barrow here. Interesting conversation last week about whether Steve Howe is right to chastise people for interrupting concerts in the way that he does. Maybe I've got a slightly different take to you guys, so I'll share my thoughts on it, which is essentially that although he possibly doesn't do it in a way that people find easy, I don't blame Steve for what he does in these kinds of situations. And I'm not talking about losing it with a lighting engineer at the 1996 San Luis Obispo rehearsals, that's a rather different question. But I'm talking about, you know, people who shout out in the middle of quiet acoustic passages, or who use flash photography, or who otherwise, you know, behave in a way that shows disrespect for the musicians, for the music, and for other people around. And remember, you know, most of us have gone to a concert to listen to the music, not to listen to some loudmouth who thinks he or she can draw attention to themselves by yelling out how much they love somebody in the middle of a quiet passage of music. I think that's really bad behaviour at a concert. Now, sure, if you want to go out and have a good time and shout and yell and sing and have the music merely as a background and talk to your neighbours and so on, by all means, go to a pub, go to a karaoke bar, but don't go to a Yes concert. Or if you do go to a Yes concert, show some respect for other people. And don't be totally shocked if one of the musicians who spent years and years preparing himself and the music that's being presented to you, finding it rather offensive that you're more interested in your own voice than you are in what's going on stage. And I think it's kind of unfortunate that this kind of thing has crept into to rock music. Those of us who spend a lot of time going to jazz or classical music or experimental music expect to have to shut up in the middle of the music. But of course, you know, then you want to really show your appreciation for the artists at the end of it. And that's when you yell and let it all out. But please, you know, don't blame a musician for feeling really kind of offended and upset by that kind of behaviour in the middle of a serious performance. So good for you, Steve. As I say, separate issue as to who should be doing speaking on behalf of Yes. And actually, I agree with your comments that it would be great to give John Davison that kind of role. He has an engaging personality. He connects with fans. He knows how to project himself, you know, vocally, you know, to a larger audience. Someone who's a bit more reserved like Steve Howe, it's probably more difficult. So good to pass that role on.
So very many thanks indeed to Ray Broccoli, Bill, Fred Barringer and Simon Barrow. And we'll see what comes out from those contributions in the future. Sorry that there's a 2-minute time limit on voice recording if you record straight into the app. So we lost a couple of bits there. Also, thank you very much to everyone who got in touch in any way this week.
Hello, this is Roger Dean, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast. Allegedly.
Unusually for this series, Lark's Tongues in Aspic is an album I've listened to many times, and it's one of my favourites. There has perhaps been even more written about King Crimson and this album than about Yes, so I'm not going to attempt to go into any depth about the history and context of the album, but rather to concentrate on listening again to it and taking note of Bill Bruford's contribution in his first important release since leaving Yes. There are, however, a few interesting passages in Bruford's autobiography about the album. He says that his first lineup in King Crimson was rather shorter lived than he'd expected. Jamie Muir left after the recording of the album, but before it was released, according to the sleeve notes in the 30th anniversary CD I have. As a result, he only receives a single sentence of description there, while the rest of the musicians have large paragraphs. While Bruford had left the revolving door of Yes after only 2 changes of the many which were to come, it looked like King Crimson were going to be rather similar in that respect. Bruford is characteristically generous to Muir, who he said he liked a lot, and had taught him some useful lessons like how to see the music from outside the drum kit, and how to serve the music, not expect it to serve him. Bruford also praises Muir's divine clattering on the album, and draws parallels with avant-garde classical composer John Cage's prepared piano works, which involved inserting various objects into the instrument, though not knives, in the Emerson fashion. If you listen to the video of Cage's sonatas and interludes for prepared piano, which I've embedded into the show notes for this week, you will immediately notice the similarities. Incidentally, I've always loved these Cage pieces. It seems that Bruford's developing ideas about what the drum kit was capable of in terms of new sounds and also melody were influenced by his time with Muir and the creation of Lark's Tongues in Aspic. Bruford tells a story of being in a car in the US with a record executive and hearing the album on the radio. Or rather, it was played on the radio by a DJ who hadn't actually heard it before. And as Bill points out, they had succeeded in shooting themselves in the foot by ignoring the demands of FM radio play. What Bruford calls Muir's twinkleberries at the start of the album were inaudible above the noise of the car, and the executive had to sit there for over 3.5 minutes before the rock riff finally kicked in. It was exploratory art, but not necessarily commercial, in the definition of the music which was dominating the charts in the US at the time. Clearly, there's a parallel here to Yes being in a car in the US and hearing the single edit of Roundabout for the first time. Apparently, they didn't know it had been chopped up and released, but at least it was a great airplay song, unlike Lark's Tongues. Anyway, with the benefit, or handicap, of almost 50 years of distance, how does the album sound to me now? Well, the twinkleberries at the start of the title song certainly are quiet, and Cross's ostinato violin pattern adds to the intriguing, tantalising feel. I've always loved the undulating finger piano and naturalistic sounds here. More is added in the way of untuned percussion, particularly bells of some kind. Maybe John Anderson snuck into the studio, but it's all still at very low volume before the whole thing seems to completely disappear, leaving just, what is it, cymbals and other metallic sounds. It certainly grabs the attention, and perhaps is clear to the listener that they are in for something rather different to the norm. 3 minutes in, Fripp's iconic guitar is heard in the background behind a vamping violin, but then disappears again, only to return and finally ramp up the volume into the heavy, grungy, nasty, dirty-sounding rocky riff. Once again, this disappears, though, to leave violin and odd bass and guitar sounds floating in and out of the texture. Then the build-up returns again for the reiteration of that huge, fuzzy riff. The dynamic range is already much greater than in the vast majority of albums I've heard, and Fripp now adds in an almost demonic electric solo before the whole band pile in with an eccentric, bouncy passage. Bass and drums combine in a fascinating way, and a recognisable theme is interspersed with percussion fiestas and towering bass solo excursions. It's perhaps difficult to make out what is Bruford and what is Muir, but whatever the case, it's electrifying in its energy and kitchen sink madness. FM radio play music. This is not. About halfway through the 13.5-minute piece, we are treated to a tender, quiet violin extemporisation, backed by percussion textures and then entirely alone. It's a beautiful section showing off the dexterity and virtuosic ability of David Cross. Tingling and tinkling semi-tuned percussion of some kind is added, and the violin double stops and trills its way to zither-like accompaniment, exploring the tonality and ebbing to nothing well before the end of the song. We can hear something coming, as if from a distance, and a violin riff layered with bass and what sounds like a recorded diatribe finally ends with an epilogue which recalls earlier material, but in a languid, fluid manner. Lark's Tongues in Aspic Part 1 contains an epic, engrossing soundscape, which fades away leaving bells and glockenspiel or similar instrumentation and a feeling of wonder. What will come next? Bruford seems entirely at home in the context of his new band here. It's as if he had always played this way, which perhaps shows his remarkable musicality and adaptability. This is a world away from the constrictions of Yes, perhaps, and Bruford appears to be in his element. The second piece is completely different, Book of Saturday, and it's one of my all-time favourites. It's only 2 minutes and 56 seconds long, and it's a proper, in inverted commas, song. After the bizarre extravaganza of the first song, this is an oasis of calm. It features some lovely vocals from Wetton, integrated with a perfectly balanced bass line, which is mobile and explorative. Fripp's guitar accompaniment is fairly straight, in his terms, but he does go in for some backwards tape effects, which remarkably don't seem out of place at all. It's a melancholy ode full of beauty and tenderness. Cross adds a subtle violin solo, and although the construction and harmonies are fairly standard, when compared with other pieces on this album, it doesn't feel contrived or banal. A wonder of construction and arrangement. There are some King Crimson Choir backing moments, and the lyrics are wonderful. You make my life a book of bluesy Saturdays. Just perfect. When I look at the track listing for this album, I think Exiles is the only song I can't immediately place. So let's give it a listen. Ah yes, this is the one which creeps in with the elephant-like percussion and Doctor Who-like ambience. It's a weird, artsy sound, like something from a sci-fi movie set on Mars. Eventually, there are a few low bassy notes and cymbal, which are the first identifiable music-type additions. Then, in a complete surprise, we have an acoustic guitar and bass-accompanied violin theme, and Bruford helps to complete the positive-sounding texture as Wetton's lyrical, nimble vocals float above. It's a lovely combination. However, we're soon back to more esoteric musings, recalling the opening as an interlude. The tempo is entirely suspended, but then we're thrust back into the song. I'm not sure if the contrast is too much, and just interrupts the flow of the piece. I don't dislike it, and maybe it would all have been too similar to Book of Saturday without this added complexity. Melancholy returns in a piano and violin-infused passage, and I really like the effect used on Wetton's voice here and elsewhere on the album. There's just a touch of a Queen choral feel, or maybe it's the other way around, and the bass line keeps the interest high. It's definitely not a Squire line, but it is mobile and well-suited to this. Fripp's electric solo is smooth and agile, combining beautifully with the violin, a great feature of this instrumentation. The song moves through lots of different sections and ends up being a complex work, although the In the Court ending might feel a touch tagged on. Still, a wonderful piece of music. Easy Money, along with 21st Century Schizoid Man, are the only two King Crimson songs I think I've ever heard used in popular culture as backing for TV commercials and documentaries. I suppose the reason why it's used elsewhere is because of its huge hooks. The dirty guitar riff and the repeated vocal phrase is unmistakable once you've heard it a single time. Wetton's solo vocal line provides a wonderful contrast, and I absolutely love the chink-chink percussion to accompany the Moxon Sneakers line. Comedy can fall completely flat in songs, but the way the lyrics are commented on and illustrated here by Bruford and Muir is hilarious. If you've ever wondered what that boinging noise is, it's called a vibra slap. So there you go. Listen to Bruford's understated but beautifully deft touches. There's no four on the floor here. He tries every approach he can think of to keep the motion going, but still be a fascinating pattern full of ingenuity. There's a bit of a jazzy improvisation feel in the middle of the song, which I imagine both Bruford and Fripp really enjoyed laying down. Muir brings in the kitchen sink again as part of an inexorable build-up, also featuring some lovely long bass lines before it ebbs again. It's laid back to the point of being horizontal, and then builds up once again. The pattern is indeed a bit like slow waves, and when the wordless chorus comes back in, it's time to marvel at the construction of this piece, which is vastly more complex than it at first seems. A fabulous recapitulation of the main vocal passages is a wonderful way to end, and you realise 7 minutes and 53 seconds have flown by as The Laughing Policeman brings you to the end of this amazing song, steeped in the weirdness of the early 1970s. I suppose we'd be expecting Bill Bruford to feature prominently in the next song, The Talking Drum, which is a reference to the hourglass-shaped instrument from West Africa. We shall see. Another 7.5-minute song, this one starts off in a vaguely similar way to Exiles. There's an instrument which I suspect is a plastic, flexible tube, blown like a trumpet and spun round. You may have seen this at children's parties. It's all very quiet indeed, and some Indian tabla, I think, join in after a bit. Then Wetton's vamping bass ostinato and some jazzy kit from Bruford. The most gradual of builds eventually adds the violin playing a mournful line, and Bruford is by now playing a more audible, consistent pattern to accompany the violin solo. There's a bit of a Romany feel to the violin part, and Fripp intertwines his electric guitar. A bit of an odd piece, it finally bursts into more life at about the 5-minute mark, and I suppose it could be seen as a good accompaniment to a mind-altered session. I find it very enjoyable, but it is perhaps a bit of an acquired taste for some who may not be prepared to take the time or effort to listen carefully. Ah, I've just remembered what's coming up. After the whirling plastic trumpet makes a re-entrance, the music ramps up and up, and there suddenly comes a screeching, ear-shattering noise as we segue straight into Lark's Tongues in Aspic Part 2. Maybe you might assume that the band didn't know how to finish the previous song off, but whatever. Listeners are unlikely to forget the experience. Part 2 opens immediately with that massive rock hook riff, which grabs hold of you and doesn't let go. The bass and guitar lines are deliberately tending towards the atonal, and there is perhaps not surprisingly a sudden shift of feel to a quieter but still insistent passage in an odd time signature, which allows Muir to throw in a whistle or two. The Fripp rock riff is worked through in creative ways, and Bruford is once again loving the quirky, spiky rhythms and sounds completely at home in this sonic environment. Muir throws in wild percussion and effects, and there's a tiny touch of the feel of Yes's Gates of Delirium battle scene, but in a much less controlled way, as Fripp foreshadows the grunge guitarists of the future as he's pitted against some squealing violin. Rhythmical and melodic intensity never let up as the musical juggernaut powers on, then relaxes for a time only to build up again. It's exhausting stuff. King Crimson's version of a rock bash ending is a wonder to behold, and lasts for a considerable time before finally fading away at the end of a progressive marathon. It's an amazing collection of songs which do share an identity. It's also amazing that Bruford sounds like he's always been there, totally settled and contributing a huge amount, as do all the members of the band. It feels like a proper band-constructed album, despite the forthcoming changes in personnel. Perhaps Bruford made the right decision to move on, for him, from Yes. Maybe.
Greetings, friends. So this week, Kevin and I are going to be taking a look at Lark's Tongues and Aspect in much more detail, as a few weeks before we had our introduction to this as we continued our What Did They Do Next series, taking a look at Mr. Bill Bruford. And as we mentioned in that first episode, the first real band that he joined after Yes was King Crimson, and was involved in probably one of their most important albums and one of their more popular records in their catalog, which was Lark's Tongues and Aspic. Now, I'm a huge King Crimson fan. They're just about as high up the ladder to me as Yes, almost. Yes is just a little bit more higher in my likings. But I have to say that King Crimson has always been an extremely influential band for me. This album, in fact, was my introduction to King Crimson. Lots of people would say that this album is a very difficult album to get into, especially for a first listen of a band that you've never heard before. So I kind of agree with that. But there was something about this album that immediately clicked with me. Now, keep in mind that I had been already listening to a lot of progressive rock by this point, so it wasn't like this was the first progressive rock album as well as it being my first King Crimson record. That would have been probably a real shock to the system. But I gotta say that a lot of the things on this record really connected, and one of those things were the drums that Bill Bruford provided in it. The interesting thing that I found about this right off the bat, and also in re-listening to it now many, many years after, is that Bill's signature drum sound that's very apparent on the Yes albums, namely his sort of snare drum sound that he has, is here as well on the King Crimson records. That doesn't always usually happen. Sometimes when drummers go to other bands, sometimes the overall sound changes from band to band, and this is something that really didn't change with Bill. So, and it's something that I also really loved about Bill is his style of playing and the sound that he gets out of his drums in general. Now, one thing that I find interesting about Bill Bruford's position in this band is the role that he played as a drummer. Now, what I mean by that is that most people think of a drummer as the backbeat of the band, the guy who kind of, you know, is the foundation of everything. But after reading several interviews about this album in particular, it's interesting what I've discovered in that King Crimson, or more particularly Robert Fripp, kind of envisioned Bill Bruford as being the sort of stay-at-home drummer for this band, and having Jamie Meir, who is the second drummer in here, to be more of the adventurous drummer percussionist in the band. Now, I always thought that that was kind of an interesting position for Bill to have, considering how renowned he was as a drummer in the music world. Lots of people consider him still to this day as one of the greatest rock slash jazz drummers slash progressive rock drummers of all time. And to think that Robert Fripp looked at him as just somebody who can, you know, kind of keep the beat and keep everything kind of grounded while Jamie Meir did all the interesting things on top of it, sort of interesting. It almost seems insulting in some ways, but Bill Bruford never took it that way. Because I think that he will even be the first to admit that he learned a great deal about drumming and of music in general from Jamie Meir. And as we kind of know from the history books, Jamie Meir was the first one picked to play drums. Bill Bruford was actually an afterthought, sort of, because when they finished doing the Islands album, three members of that band were immediately dismissed after that tour, which were Mel Collins, Boz Buell, and Ian Wallace. And they had also lost Peter Sinfield before, not long before that, who was the co-director, artistic director, lyricist, kind of a man of many different traits for the band. So really, Robert was starting all over again with this band, and the first person that he got in was actually John Wetton, and then Jamie Meir. So Bill was near the end of the people hired into the band. So, but it's very interesting because when I listen to this record, his drumming is really well done. It does seem a little stay-at-home-ish more than what we get to hear later, because when you listen to albums later on, like Thrack, for example, where they went back to the double drummer situation again, and they brought in Pat Mastelotto, Bill Bruford refers to Lark's Tongues and Aspect in saying that when that happened, the positions now were flipped, that Pat Mastelotto was brought in to be the stay-at-home sort of drummer that kind of covered all the basic groundwork. And Bill Bruford at this point was the man who did all the experimentation. He had the electronic drums, you know, as well as his regular drum set. And he was the one who was providing more of the interesting, intricate stuff in there. And it really turned out fantastic. And this sort of thinking has gone on with King Crimson years and years later now. Now we're up to three drummers and all kinds of different percussion elements are brought in now at this point. But in this album, the drumming was very well planned out and devised for the music that was written. For me, I think this record top to bottom is fantastic. I don't think there's a weak song on here. They opened with Lark's Tongues and Aspect Part 1, which was actually the song that they opened their tour that I saw them with, I believe, in 2017. And I won't be ashamed to say that when they played that, I did notice that I kind of teared up a little bit because it was so well done and such an impactful opening song. It just really touched me. I couldn't believe how well they played it, and it sounded absolutely amazing. And it was a good example of how the multiple drummer situation really helps and can make a song like that be so much more than it could have been with just one drummer. Now, other songs in this album that really stand out to me are, for example, Easy Money. This is a more straight-ahead kind of rock song, but again, what they can do with it in this situation, especially with Bill's drumming, it was just fantastic. It has a strong beat to it. And while Jamie Muir, in my opinion, doesn't have as much to do experimentally in this song, this is a song that really makes Bill stand out. He has some great drum rolls that he does in here. Just fantastic playing. Then we get to the Talking Drum, which is the second last song on the record. And there again is something that is very well constructed. And again, a great showing of the two drummers. And especially with Bill, I find in this. I find that, you know, yes, a lot of this has to do with Jamie, but I think that Bill's style of drumming really helped in this song. And years later, when they did songs like this, you can tell that he had a great knowledge of different kinds of drumming styles. For example, when they did The Sheltering Sky on the Discipline record years later, he used a sort of an African drum, and it was fantastic. And that was the only drum that he used through the whole song, and how he could just use one drum to propel a song is just amazing. But getting back to this album, it closes with what's probably one of their more signature songs. I guess this song would be kind of looked at almost like the sort of roundabout for Yes, which is Lark's Tongues and Aspect Part 2. Very signature guitar riff to it. And just the song in general, being that it's even an instrumental, is very popular amongst the fan base and even very popular amongst non-King Crimson people, but specifically more towards the progressive rock fan base, obviously. Great drumming, great interplay within the members. And again, I think that this album in general really broadened Bill's playing. And I'm pretty sure I read in a few places that Bill said that he had learned a lot in recording this album just by being in the presence of these guys, especially in being in the presence of Jamie Muir. I mean, he taught him a lot how not to be afraid to kind of take chances in certain ways. And, you know, let's face it, the music that King Crimson wrote was vastly different than Yes. And even if Bill wanted to do something as experimental as he did on this record, he just probably couldn't do it because there was just no room for it. I mean, you couldn't do some of these crazy things that they did on a Yes song. It just probably wouldn't have fit. So I think that he learned a lot about himself as a drummer and about what you can do with a song by just watching Jamie and these other guys work their magic. So I definitely think that getting this album is a must-have for people who love Bill Bruford's drumming style. And if I can make two suggestions, there's a 30th anniversary version of this album that came out that's on CD that's really well done. I like the mastering of it. I like it better than the 40th anniversary, to be quite honest. That's just me personally with my sort of nitpicking. Just sonically, I like the sound of it better, that remaster. But if you do have the money, may I suggest that you pick up the Lark's Tongue and Aspect box set that came out. Now, most people say that it's the weakest of the box sets, but the book in it is fantastic. All the notes that they have about the recording of this record is in there. You have some fantastic posters that you get, sort of memorabilia, and you have a lot of extra CDs of some of the recordings. Now, the live show recordings, most of them are pretty crappy sounding. They're like audience recordings, but there are a few soundboard ones that sound really good. But most importantly, they have a lot of alternate takes, a lot of different sorts of, you know, alternate mixes as well of the songs, and they're really worth having. There's a lot of sections where they show the band just working on parts alone, and just those sections where they have just Jamie Muir and, let's say, Robert Fripp just working on a part, just them two, it's just worth having. And there's even parts with Bill working on a song separately with Jamie, just the percussion end of it. It's really amazing to hear these songs worked on such a basic level and to hear what they did to make them into some of the masterpieces that they became. I would highly, highly, highly recommend getting the box set if you have the means to get it. So those are my views on Lark's Tongues and Aspect with the fantastic Bill Bruford. And now let's go over to Kevin and discuss it further.
So there's our comments on this great King Crimson album, and of course with Bill Bruford. And I'm here now with Mark. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. So, well, plenty to say about this King Crimson album. And it was my first King Crimson album as well, bizarrely. It was just, I just happened to find it in the record shop, I think. And as we talked about a few weeks ago now, noticed that Bill Bruford was on there as well. So had to check it out. And King Crimson, one of those bands that are so popular amongst the 5%ers, amongst our sort of people, but certainly weren't in the charts in the same way even as Yes. I mean, Yes had that amazing 90125 period when they were even on the television quite a bit, but King Crimson very much not. Although I may have seen, perhaps, a video of Lark's Tongues and Aspect Part 2 on the old Grey Whistle Test or somewhere like that, but I certainly wasn't aware of them in the same way as I was of Yes. However, you mentioned, and I've said before, that it's a difficult album to get into, but I was interested in your comments that you had been around progressive rock, around this sort of music maybe, more than some others who've tried to get into this album. And certainly if this is your first exposure to King Crimson, to progressive rock, tricky to get into, and it certainly was for me.
Yeah, I mean, definitely if you're just venturing into prog rock, and this is your first, you know, foray into it, not a good selection, because it's definitely going to be one of those things where you're going to be scratching your head a lot of times and going, what am I listening to here? What am I supposed to be getting out of this? But like I said, because I've already kind of dug deep into some of the other, you know, bands and some of the other albums and stuff like that, you know, it made sense to me what they were doing, but, you know, it was definitely still not an easy listen. I mean, you know, opening a record with, you know, Lark's Tongues and Aspect Part 1.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty hefty thing to devour.
It is indeed. And it's hefty in a different kind of way to some of the other King Crimson albums. Now, I'm not an expert on King Crimson, but I know the first two very well. And actually, my preference of the first two albums is for In the Wake of Poseidon, which I think was the second album. I like that rather more than the first amazing debut album. So, if you had to advise someone, you wouldn't advise them to start with Lark's Tongues in Aspic, certainly. Where would you invite them to start with King Crimson of the early albums? I'm not talking about the 80s where things rather changed.
That's an interesting question, because a lot of the times their music is still highly complicated and, you know, not the easiest to swallow. To be honest with you, I always refer people to two records if you're going to start out with King Crimson. One is the debut. I think the debut has enough melody and just straight ahead sort of song structure to it that people can kind of relate to it, like 21st Century Schizoid Man, you know?
Yeah.
Or even In the Court of the Crimson King, you know, songs like that. While they're long and lengthy, they still have a lot of, you know, elements that still people can relate to. And, you know, 21st Century Schizoid Man, believe it or not, was played on radio, you know.
It
wasn't completely away from radio altogether like some of their later material was. And the other record that I kind of guide people towards is Red, because I find that that one is more heavier. I find that it's also more... not so overblown in spots. I mean, sure, we have Starless, which is like a huge epic, but that's very much more like a almost like an epic prog ballad, almost in a sense. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting things on Red. There's like, you know, oboe and other kind of instruments in there. And, you know, there's a lot of good vocals on there by Mr. Wetton on there. I think that that's one of the ones that I think people connect to a lot. I mean, the thing that kind of struck me about that is that Kurt Cobain, of all people, cited Red as a record that he really loved. And I mean, this is somebody who's into more like, you know, the Melvins and Sex Pistols and that kind of music. And to cite King Crimson's Red, I mean, there had to be something more on the street level sound-wise for him to kind of relate to it.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And we've gone rather off the topic of Yes and what Bill Bruford did next, because Red wasn't the album we're talking about, but it is a fascinating album, Red, and And I think it was way, way ahead of its time. I mean, I used to listen to it. I had no idea what date was on it because I never bothered to look at the date. And then years later, after listening to it so many times, I looked at it and, what is it, 74 or something like that? I mean, it's really early. I thought it was more like a 1980s album because it just has so much power. And as you say, and interestingly, my son, who is into quite a lot of metal and I don't know what category you call it, but some really dark stuff he's into. And he loves Red as well. But anyway, we must stop talking about Red and talk about Lark's Tongues in Aspic. Now, I was very interested to hear what you said about Bill's signature snare sound. And that's very interesting, isn't it? Because if you think about some other members who've left, yes, have they taken their sound with them in the same way? And maybe perhaps not, or even those who've gone on to play with Asia. So if you imagine Steve Howe, Alan White playing with John Lennon, does it always sound like Steve Howe? Does it always sound like Alan White? Perhaps it does, but very much so. You can tell that this is Bruford playing on this album, can't you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that snare drum sound of his is so signature. I mean, I can pick that snare drum out anywhere on all the things, whether it's Earthworks, UK, even when I was watching some of this old footage of when he was with Genesis briefly.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he has that pong snare drum sound that's so signature to him.
Yeah.
And, you know, well, that's the thing. I mean, drummers have it hard. I mean, a lot of the times a guitar can be attached to a certain player, like an SG is attached to Tony Iommi, or the ES-175 or 152 is attached to Steve Howe, right?
Yep.
And, you know, so sometimes they have it easier, but a drummer, what can he, you know, you can't say that one Gretsch drum set sounds all the same. Wood is a funny thing with drum sets. They change with time and, you know, warpage happens and stuff like that. So things change in tone, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But the snare drum is the one instrument that the drummer has that he can probably craft around his liking and kind of keep, because most drummers kind of keep the snare drum and sometimes get rid of the rest of the kit, right? So I kind of think that that's a very interesting thing. And he did mention, funny enough, about Steve Howe, about whether or not his sound, you know, stayed with him throughout his different changes. And while I think it did for the most part, but Asia's interesting because I thought Asia was the first time that he had kind of increased his distortion and stuff like that. It was a much heavier sound than he had for Yes. But of course, we're talking about Bill, so let's get back to Mr. Bruford.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was fascinated. I hadn't read what you read about Robert Fripp bringing him in to essentially keep the beat and not be the sort of creative one. And Bruford, Bill Bruford, is not the kind of person that you can keep down in terms of creation and being creative. And I certainly don't think he does that. There's an enormous ingenuity and creativity in all his parts in this album, I think. He certainly does push the boundaries as usual.
Yeah, that's for sure. But I think what I was trying to say, though, is that because that quote came directly from Bill himself when he was talking about the Thrack album many, many years later, saying that how when they brought Pat Mastalotto in, that the roles were reversed, that when he was with Jamie Muir, that he was kind of brought in as the, you know, keep it together guy and let Jamie run wild on top of it. And whereas in Thrack, it was the opposite. Let Pat keep it together. And then he was allowed to do all kinds of crazy ideas and stuff on top of it.
Yeah.
So I don't think that it meant that he was just going to go boom, ba, ba, boom, boom, ba, on drums and that's it. You know, obviously he did a lot more to it than that. Yeah. But I think that when it came to, you know, the leaf throwing and the whistle blowing and all these crazy, you know, bicycle horns and stuff like that, that wasn't something that was really in Bill's vocabulary at that point. I think that he was even taken aback by some of these things that he saw, like this crazy rack of percussion that Jamie would set up and play, because there was a great video of them at the Beat Club when they were playing. And they have, he has all kinds of stuff there. And there was a great video of them when you see Jamie going in, reaching into this garbage bag full of leaves and just throwing it into the air in a quiet section of a song that they did, some improvisational song. And I mean, you could even kind of look at Bill's face and going, what is this guy doing? You know? So I think that this was a very, it was almost like percussion university for him, you know, like what you could do besides just playing on a drum set. You can do so much more percussion wise.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And the parallel between this and Union with two drummers, of course, is fascinating, because by that time Bill was using his electronic percussion and he came in. And I think he did feel at the time of Union that Alan White did a lot of the heavy lifting for the Union tour, but Bill Bruford was there adding to it. And there's a bit of a role reversal thing going on there with that. And fascinating that Muir didn't stay. So this is all down to the Fripp trying to construct the band as he has always done, it seems. It seems he hires and fires, and he is certainly the central point of King Crimson. And I don't know whether the fans have the similar sort of attitude towards King Crimson as certain Yes fans do, in terms of no Wakeman, no Yes, no Nor Anderson, no Yes, and no no Whetton, no King Crimson. I don't know. But it's certainly a very different way of thinking about a band, isn't it? He seems to have picked and chosen exactly who he wanted for a particular type of music, a particular type of album. And in this case, Jamie Muir left before the album came out. So interesting that experiment of King Crimson didn't seem to work in this case.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, I've been really a really, really deep fan with King Crimson. I've been reading a lot of stuff. I buy a lot of the box sets, so I do a lot of really deep research onto their stuff. But I'll tell you one thing that I've noticed, because being in a lot of their different forums as well and fan pages, that's one thing that King Crimson has sort of to their advantage, is that they don't have that sort of view on it. To them, as long as Robert Fripp is in it, it's King Crimson. Whoever comes in is interchangeable besides him. I mean, the only person that I've heard people within the fan community make a little bit of a stink over is Adrian Belew, that they sometimes say that, oh, they should bring him back for vocals. It's because they always talk about the vocal and some of the crazy guitar playing that he added in King Crimson in that 80s period, and then later with Thrack in the 90s there too. But beyond that, I mean, you know, no offense to the other people, including Bill, but, you know, I've never really heard too big a stink about it. To them, it's very clear. Yeah. Robert Fripp is King Crimson.
Yeah.
You know, so there's none of this, you know, John Wetton, no King Crimson, you know? So I think that they had that kind of advantage in there. And I said, you know, people like the Jamie Muir thing, people kind of look back at that as a little flash in the pan time period in it, but it is looked back very positively. Like, people kind of always refer back to those video segments and say, wow, this is great. Or, for example, another great example is on their website, they have this thing where you can buy old shows that they have on, you know, cassette from soundboard recordings and stuff like that. And one of the big discoveries lately was that they found an old soundboard from the Lark's Tongue era, right when Jamie was still with them, right before he left.
Right.
And there was like a concert with him performing on it. So that was a big, like, yay, we found something with Jamie on it. So it's not that people don't care about the other members. It's just that to them, you know, as long as Robert's involved in it, that's the main brain of King Crimson.
Yeah, fascinating. It's just a shame that Yes doesn't have the same relationship, perhaps. But I suppose there's a certain difference in that founder members, etc. But anyway, we're turning into the King Crimson music podcast at the moment, but that's fine. So back to this album then, and Whetton. I thought Whetton was absolutely extraordinary, both in bass and vocals. I mean, this is the closest I've come to you know, having a parallel type of bass sound and approach to my love of Chris Squire. I thought he was absolutely extraordinary on this album.
Yeah, I think he's very, very strong on this. The singing on songs like Book of Saturday or Exiles is just fantastic, like really nicely done. And for somebody who has such a, you know, strong and sometimes, you know, rough and gravelly voice when he wants to, he can sing really nice and softly too, and really evoke emotion very nicely in it. And when he needs to make it a bit more snarly and growly, like for like Easy Money or something, he has the ability to do it.
Yeah.
So, and you know, again, with Bill's contribution to this record, drumming-wise, I mean, it's the same thing drumming-wise. I mean, he can be very subtle and delicate for stuff like Exiles or something like Book of Saturday, but he can really kick it up a notch for like Easy Money or Lark's Tongues and Aspect Part 2, for example.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's interesting you mention how good he is on Book of Saturday and Easy Money and Exiles. Book of Saturday, particularly, and Easy Money, I tend to think when I'm not listening to the album, I have this actually incorrect view that those two are the kind of easy ones to listen to and that they're fairly straightforward and simple songs, but they're not actually when you listen to them. There's an awful lot packed even into those ones. There are a lot of different sections, a lot of changes of tempo and mood, etc., even within those two songs, and both of them are long songs, you know, in terms of pop music. They are both 7 minute plus songs. There's an awful lot of complexity to everything really on this album, isn't there?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the way that they kind of write out their songs is really interesting. I think the arrangement is one of the strong parts of the whole King Crimson, you know, writing style. Yeah. That they really come up with some fantastic different things that keep people interested, but not too overblown. I think that's something that kind of happens a little bit later in their career, is that sometimes they draw out stuff a little bit too long. But, you know, this album to me is the closest thing to a masterpiece prog album that you could probably find. I mean, I kind of put it up there along the lines of Close to the Edge, but I give Close to the Edge the advantage in the sense that I think that melodically and vocally, it still is a better record.
Yeah, yeah. So fascinating that Bill left after he didn't think he could do anything else with Yes after exactly that album you just mentioned, Close to the Edge, and he goes and creates another classic with Lark's Tongues in Aspic. Amazing stuff. Now, let's just play the game of had Bill stayed, could he have done with Yes? And one of the things I thought of with this, of course, Alan White coming in, was when you get as far as Relayer and in Sound Chaser, there are perhaps some echoes of the King Crimson in terms of the percussion and the at least appearing to be a freer way of playing and a freer way of arranging. And you could certainly see Bill playing on Relayer, couldn't you?
I could. He definitely has the ability to do it. Just the one thing that I noticed that's marketably different, though, and I think Steve Howe was the first person to bring it up, or maybe even it was Chris Squire, that Alan had a little bit more of that rock drive to him than Bill did at that time. My favorite example to bring up to anybody when it comes to Relayer, whenever I say, listen, if you're going to buy a new stereo system and you want to test it out, put on Sound Chaser, because that drum set sound and that song is phenomenal. And just that whole bit with the toms at the beginning, that whole drum roll at the beginning that he does there.
Yeah.
I mean, I can hear Bill do that now, but back in that time period, I don't know if he would have approached it the same way as Alan did. I think Alan had a little bit more rock and roll drive to him. He had a little bit more of that sort of, you know, touches of almost like a Neil Peart thing, like approach to it at that point, you know, even though Neil Peart was not even anywhere near Rush at that point. But it's just funny, though, that I can kind of hear that kind of a style. So maybe, you know, Alan is obviously a direct influence to Neil, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, that sort of drumming style, I think, is a little bit different than what Bill would have did at that time. Yeah. I think that if Bill would have been playing on like Sound Chaser or even Gates of Delirium, I think his drumming would have been a little bit different. Not worse, just different.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to know what Bill thinks of Relayer. And if you know, then please do leave a comment on the show notes for this week. But looking back over this album, which is, as I said, one of my favourite albums of all time, you've got things like that Jamie Muir influence. You've got Bill Bruford in there with some remarkable drum lines. You've got John Wetton, as we've said, with fantastic bass and vocals, but of course in a very different sense to Yes vocals. And you've got Robert Fripp, of course, holding the whole thing together, playing Mellotron and devices, as it says on the back cover, and as well as that guitar, which again couldn't be anyone else. So typically him. And then, of course, you've got David Cross, violin, viola, and Mellotron. So a remarkable album. And a remarkable first album, I think, and the way that Bill seems to have fitted in perfectly, even though I think he was fairly nervous about it. I think it was a challenge to go into King Crimson and to adopt a rather different approach to what he was used to in Yes, but an amazing album to be able to produce as your first in a new band.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I agree with you that I think that there was a bit of nerves involved with this too, because like he said, this is like now kind of foreign territory. He brought up the fact that the influences that, you know, Robert Fripp had or members of the band were very different than the ones that were influencing Yes. So to him, he was kind of just, you know, going into unknown territory. But I think that's exactly what he wanted. I think that what he was realizing with Yes is that he was already kind of knowing almost what was going to be happening with them. Like, he kind of almost predicted what was going to be happening musically with them. And that's probably why he already figured, you know what? I don't think I can do more with this because I kind of already know what we're going to be doing. You know what I mean? Yeah. He was so familiar with them as a band and as people that he kind of always predicted in his mind, at least, what was going to be happening next. He always said that they had this very major chord, happy sunshine kind of approach. And he was looking for something that was a little bit more minor chordish and a little bit more darker sounding. And that's exactly what he got with King Crimson.
Yeah, definitely. And definitely with this album, there's so much of a different soundscape to anything that he did with Yes, that it is remarkable. But as usual, don't take our words for it. What do you think of what Bill did on Lark's Tongues in Aspic? Did he broaden his mind and broaden his playing? And was it the right move for him? Leave your comments on the show notes for this week. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
I've had all Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says. I've had all Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says.
Just before we go, here's the patron update. Half of the patrons are Mark James Lang, Martin Kjellberg, Michael O'Connor, Miguel Falcao, Neil Caffrey, Paul Hales, Paul Tomei, Paul Wilson, Peter Herndon, Lobate Scarp, Rachel Hadaway, Mark Sarkle Bags, Robert Nasa, Scott Colombo, Scott Smith, Simon Barrow, Stephen Lamb, Steve Dill, Steve Perry, Steve Rode, Steve Scott, Stephen Raw, Terence Sadler, Tim Stannard, Todd Dudley, Tony Handley, Joseph Cottrell, Keith Hoisington, William Hayes, and Michael Handahan. Also, continued thanks to Robert and David. So as always, thank you very much indeed to those patrons. They are helping the show financially. And if you'd like to join them in doing that, just go to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or click on the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. I do hope we'll be back next week. But in the meantime, you can follow the show on Twitter, on Instagram, or on Facebook. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.